to see if we really understand what's going on.
Thanks, Bruce. And I was going to turn to you. You preempted the role of the moderator. I was just getting ready to turn to privacy.
James, can I respond to the consumer welfare point real quick before we?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Why not? I'll just cede complete control to the panelists.
So just one small thing to add. You do often hear this complaint about the consumer welfare standard that it's all about price, and that is incorrect. And both of these explanations are absolutely right. What I do want to say is I think the kernel of truth in that statement is that we often find at court that price arguments are relied upon more often, and they are sort of accepted by judges more often. And so there is a little bit of a push in the direction of prices having more of an impact than quality or innovation assessments. And I think it's just because they're easier to measure, they're easier for judges to understand. It's not an immutable part of the law, certainly not part of the statute, but it just tends to happen a lot. So it's not a made-up concern, but that's the nuanced explanation.
Oh. Well, anyway, Charlotte, why have you on the spot? I just wanted to, you know, and Bruce started the conversation. I think, if I understand what you said before, that antitrust wouldn't be the proper tool to go after privacy problems, right? But what Bruce was talking about is sort of subtly different is having privacy within an antitrust analysis. So we're talking about, you know, to tie it all together, you know, we're talking about zero price markets in the you have to look at maybe other metrics. John mentioned an implicit price when I have to watch an ad or the website's cluttered or whatever it might be. And another metric that people have discussed, and Bruce kicked it off here, is having privacy of the amount of data. So I've heard it articulated in two ways. One would be, you know, privacy or data of the price we pay for using something, or the other is the more data or the less privacy, the lower the quality is. And both are, but neither one is a price metric per se. And I'm just, what role do you see privacy or data collection playing in an antitrust analysis?
So there's a few different ways I think that antitrust enforcers think about this. So data can be an important asset that is transferred in a merger, but they are not thinking about it from the perspective of consumer privacy, right? They'll think about it from the perspective of an important asset that's transferred in the merger. So I think a lot of times when we hear about mergers that are happening, like I got questions about this with Google Fitbit, you know, is the FTC going to consider the concerns about people's privacy now that Google's going to have this health information? That's not the responsibility of antitrust, so we need privacy legislation. But another way to think of it is privacy as a quality measure, which we've already talked about a little bit. I actually do think that antitrust enforcers can more accurately assess privacy as a quality measure, so you could use it in these zero price markets where the price sort of could be your attention or it could be your data. I do think that expert enforcers can do that quality assessment even if consumers can't. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's good. And John, I'll let you, if you have any follow-up to that, because one thing, and this plays off a little bit of what Bruce said, is the extent you could imagine, you know, two merging companies and one has they have different privacy policies, or you look and you look at the different qualities. To what extent does the salience of privacy to consumers matter in that? So if it's not something that consumers are overly concerned about in that respect, you know, and the other thing, and this goes into something that Bruce talked about too, is the quality, is that there is a subtle distinction, I think, between the quality, you know, if you hold the price constant and you reduce the quality of a car, say, you know, take the air conditioner out or make the radio worse, hold the price constant, the quality adjusted price is gone up, right? But to Bruce's point, when you don't automatically profit by taking more data. If you have to monetize that somehow, and that monetization often at the end of the day is a benefit to some consumers. We have heterogeneous preferences. Does that play into the consideration as well? And as far as the ability to use privacy within an antitrust analysis?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing in concept that keeps privacy out of antitrust, but it's just how is it being put in. And so So, for instance, if privacy truly was sort of a linear correlation with quality, in that the more privacy you receive for a given product, that the higher the quality of the product is for you. And so let's say that firms compete on quality, and so post-merger we would think that we have some loss of competition, and so they compete less vigorously on your privacy, and so we would observe a drop in privacy, which is effectively a drop in quality, which, as James mentioned, even if the nominal price doesn't change, the real price has changed because the quality adjusted price is now higher. That's a valid antitrust theory of harm. There's nothing wrong with that. The question then is, to Bruce's point, is that is privacy sort of this linear relationship in that the more market power a firm gets, the less privacy you get? And is that a harm to you, the less privacy you have? And so I think the problem is with these platforms, privacy plays both sides. On one respect, we don't want them to take more privacy than needed, but we are willing to concede privacy being, let's just define it as user data, that you would consider outside of the platform something you wouldn't want others to use, but within a platform, you're okay with them using. For instance, the mapping example is an excellent example, but also Facebook collecting your likes and determining the type of ads that you would most likely respond to, as well as the type of news feeds that would sort of cater to your interests, or YouTube. When a late night session with YouTube, you're led to one video, to another video, all because it's suggesting things that you're like, oh, yeah, maybe I should watch this one more. It's all very helpful for you to some degree. A little weird in another degree, right? But we're willing to trade that off because we're getting, presumably, a higher quality product, a more tailored and curated product. So the point I'm trying to make here is not that privacy is a universal, let's give everything to these platforms, but it plays an interesting role. In some respects, it's useful to us. In some respects, we want it bounded within that use. And we don't want it misused, and I think everyone would agree with that. But it's not a straight linear relationship, so that's why its relationship in an antitrust case is more delicate. And I think it's more case specific.
Yeah. Bruce, you wanted to jump in? I'm sorry, then I'll get to you, Charlotte.
Yeah. Just a couple of quick points. One is, I think it's also important to remember that there are consumer protection laws at issue here. And there may be gaps in those laws, which I know Charlotte has thought about some, but in privacy in the U.S., we treat it under the FTC Act primarily as a disclosure issue. In other words, if you tell people adequately what you are doing, then it's okay. We don't have a normative view, John, use your word, of how much privacy there should be. There's not a law that says X amount of privacy is required. We just simply say, as long as you tell people what you're doing, that's fine. That may be a problem, right? It may be that, first of all, people can't understand those warnings, or they can't read them, or they don't really know what the use are, or that people cheat on them. You know, there's any number of possibilities that may merit addressing through the vehicle of some sort of privacy rule or consumer protection type rule or law aimed at that area. But that gets into a normative question of what do we as a society think ought to be some default level or minimal level of privacy. Antitrust doesn't try to answer that question. Antitrust simply asks, are people benefiting, does a merger or does conduct, whether it's an agreement or unilateral conduct by a firm, make people better off or worse off in an objective economic sense? And so antitrust is not well suited to say there should be this level of privacy. It simply says, well, look, the competition is producing this certain amount of privacy, and post-merger or post-conduct, there's going to be a different level. And then we try to figure out, is that a good or a bad thing in the sense of what's the economic effect? Very different kind of issue, and one that, and this is, I think, where a lot of the confusion about the role of privacy in antitrust comes from.
Yeah. Charlotte?
So I think there's this idea that people don't care about privacy because we see their behaviors. But economists like to use the actions that we take as evidence that that's the thing that we want, and it's really not always true. I think your YouTube example is a perfect one. Like, if you're watching YouTube video after YouTube video because it's recommended, economists would say that's what you want. I think that's not what you want. I think you're being manipulated by the system to do a thing that you later regret and wish you didn't do.
Especially when it's 2 a.m. here.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, we eat a cookie even though we, you know, want, we like make a decision at the beginning of the year. I am going to diet this year and I'm going to eat healthy, and that's what you want. But then you end up eating cookies. And so the economist would say, well, you wanted to eat cookies. this is a consumer protection issue, right? We don't just want, you can't just solve everything by saying what's economically most efficient, and we can't assume that because people are not staying away from products that violate their privacy, that means they want their privacy violated.
The only thing I would add is, going back to YouTube late at night, I'm not saying there's regret, not regret, but hopefully we learn from that regret and go forward. But I do think that we're, I think we're in dangerous territory when we say that consumers who click on a video and watch the video and then continue to watch the video, that they're being manipulated. You know, for children, I think that's fair, and I think that's true for adults. I think we're just running into public policy questions when we go to that level. That's my view. Of course, I'm going to defend the economic approach, which is reveal preferences, tell us what consumers prefer. And I think as a general, that's a good guiding principle. There are exceptions and individual cases where that's going to be wrong. But in the aggregate, I think that's a general rule that's pretty good.
I mean, just as an aside, this will be next week's panel on behavioral economics. But this is. I'm just kidding. No, but if there's free lunch, everyone would be here anyway. But there is actually a robust debate over this exact problem of time inconsistent preferences, or hyperbolic discounting, as it's called. That which self has more dignity? The self, as Charlotte says at the beginning of the year, that says I want to work out every day, and the self that actually doesn't, which is revealed preference. And there's actually a robust discussion, mostly philosophical, because there's really no way you can come to an answer, but which self is the real self, right? The one who actually makes the decision, or the one who's actually making the decision that didn't abide to the previous decision, or the one who made that plan that isn't being adhered to. Anyway, so let's move back to antitrust. So we don't have too much time left, but I did want to talk, since we have the director of the Bureau of Competition here, talk a little bit about mergers. And one of the criticisms, not just levied at the FTC, I mean, it happens to be the FTC with the example I'm going to use with Instagram and Facebook, but just in general that there have been misses with respect to nascent competition or potential competition, and I raise the Facebook, Instagram, that's often raised as kind of the poster child of, well, and I you weren't there at the time, so if it was a mistake, you can blame it on John. I think he was there. but Charlotte, you were there too, I think. So yes, there.
But she wasn't in a merger shop.
Yeah. So not John. Anyway, the issue there is, you know, do you think that at the time maybe. Were agencies in general too concerned with false positives and too much of a blind spot to false negatives? And I raised this, especially we're here on Capitol Hill there. Amy Klobuchar has a bill that would, and I don't know if she's the only one, but there that would actually change the, basically put in the Philadelphia National Bank presumption and then say once there's certain concentration, then you've actually established your prima facie case that there's likely to be harm to substantial harm to competition, or whatever the Clayton 7 language is. And so I just wanted to ask you, I mean, do you think that there was a problem in the past, or there needs to be a recalibration? And I understand that you're on the spot since you still got some time here and there's maybe not that much you could say.
Oh, there's a lot I can say.
Yeah.
I'm never at a loss for words. A couple things. First, let me talk a little bit about Facebook, Instagram, and then I want to talk about acquisitions and the way they're reviewed and nascent competitors, right. And then go from that, I think, to this question about changing burdens and whatnot. Facebook, Instagram is flagged a lot as an example of an anti-competitive merger that was missed because Instagram was identified as a nascent competitor to Facebook. It wasn't a meaningful competitor at the time. It had, I think, 12 employees or something like that and almost no revenue. But the idea was that Instagram would have become the big rival to Facebook, and allowing Facebook to buy it was a big mistake. I mean, first and foremost, I think it's worth noting that every antitrust agency in the world cleared that transaction. It was reviewed in Europe, it was reviewed in China, it was reviewed in the US, everyone cleared it. Second, it's not at all obvious that that decision was wrong, because the important thing that people need to remember is you can't judge what Instagram would have become by what it has become under the ownership of Facebook. When you buy a small entity, you're a big company like Facebook, you buy a small entity, you give that small entity a lot of stuff that it didn't have. It's entirely possible that absent the transaction, Instagram would have withered on the vine and been nothing. No one knows. And this is the sort of thing that you do merger retrospectives to try to figure out, would in fact it have been likely that Instagram would have been on its own a major competitor to Facebook or not? Because if not, then the transaction would not have necessarily been any competitive. And in fact, the UK looked back at this and was unable to conclude that they got it wrong when they cleared that transaction, because they couldn't tell whether Instagram would in fact have ever evolved into a significant competitor to Facebook. But having said that, I will say a couple things. Number one, the possibility that an incumbent firm is harming competition by buying nascent rivals, small rivals, is absolutely a valid possibility, and we know it has happened. There have been plenty of cases. We have brought some at the FTC in the last couple of years challenging transactions by dominant firms of really tiny rivals or rivals whose competitive significance we felt was greatly under-predicted by their current status. So this is a viable theory of antitrust harm. It's something the agency specifically look at. Number two, do we get it wrong? Absolutely. We get stuff wrong. You know, we're human. The agencies make mistakes. They are going to miss things now and then. Sometimes we'll block mergers we shouldn't have. Sometimes we'll fail to block mergers we should have. There's no question about that. Any law enforcement system will have error in it. Now, we do have error correction techniques. We can go back and challenge mergers after the fact, after they have been consummated. We just won one, actually, in the market for microprocessor artificial knees, where it was an anti-competitive transaction that we went back and challenged after the fact. So we can do that. It can be hard, because sometimes it's hard to figure out, as I said before, what would have happened, but we do that. Third, should the standards be changed? I would say my short answer to that is I don't know, but I'm very suspicious about it for a couple of reasons. Number one, I probably should go to A. A, because I was on three, so this would be 3A. A, we win almost all of our cases. I think the FTC's track record of merger litigation is currently hovering at about a 90% win rate. So to say that we need some sort of legal help, I think, is highly questionable. Little B, it is possible that that is so. We win most of these cases because of a selection problem where we're only bringing easy cases, but I can tell you that is absolutely not true. In fact, almost all the cases that we litigate are cases that we think are really hard. And why do they litigate? They litigate because they're hard cases. The cases that are easy never get anywhere near litigation. People either don't do those mergers, or they realize when we're going to sue them that they need to abandon them. And we actually have a lot of abandonments over the last few years where when people realize we were going to sue them, they abandon the merger rather than face us in court. And I can tell you that the number of cases where we say either one of two things, either one, we're going to go to trial, but it's a lay down hand. We're going to win this one easily because it's obviously getting competitive. That's almost a null set. It's happened once or twice, but it's very rare. But number two, the number of cases we don't bring because we say, well, it's a really close call, we're not sure we can win, is pretty close to a null set as well. And I was at the FTC before. I served under Chairman Tim Uris. And Tim said, back when I was there in 2001, he said, you know what? We should not be afraid of losing cases, right? We're the government. We lose the case, then we lost the case. But we were trying our best to win the case that we thought should have been brought. And in fact, at the FTC, we have a long track record of when we lose cases, if we think we were right, we bring the same doggone case again. We did it with reverse payments. We did it with state action immunity. We did it with Norr Pennington. We did it with hospital mergers. You know, when we thought the courts were getting it wrong, we just keep bringing these cases until eventually we get the courts to get it right. So there's not a fear. I mean, I can't speak for Department of Justice, but they certainly have brought a lot of cases. And certainly at the FTC, there's not a fear of loss of litigation that's driving our decision-making. So to say that the standards need to be changed, so that, for example, large mergers are anti-competitive, so say if Boeing bought Kentucky Fried Chicken, that would be viewed as inherently anti-competitive, I don't think is an obvious case. The dollar value of a transaction is a really poor marker of whether it has a competitive effect. So ultimately, I think this is something people could continuously look at. Currently, the law is very favorable to merger challenges. If the concentration is high, we get a presumption. The area where this fails, by the way, is vertical mergers, where we don't have these presumptions. But in horizontal mergers, the law is pretty favorable to us in the cases that we bring.
Yeah. Thanks, Bruce. I'll let you guys weigh in, but I'm still thinking about Kentucky Fried Chicken on my airplane. I mean, I hope that merger happens. That's all I would
It would definitely improve airline.
Yeah, I'd love that. So Charlotte and John, would you like to weigh in on this?
Great. So I do think changing the presumptions is a good idea, and I support that Klobuchar bill. You should look into it. It's great. So I feel like Bruce already sort of made the arguments that I want to make, and I just disagree. The fact that they win all the cases, I think, is an indication that they're not bringing hard enough cases. I think when we have situations of uncertainty and there are close call cases, people are concerned, including me, that the FTC is not bringing the hard cases in those bubble situations. Part of that is choices by the FTC, but part of that is the law. There is a presumption in antitrust law that in situations of uncertainty, it's better to have under enforcement rather than over enforcement, and I think that presumption is a problem. This is based on the idea that barriers to entry are generally low, and so if we make a mistake and allow a monopoly to happen, it'll probably get fixed by competitors coming in and competing away the monopoly profits, and the market will return to a nice competitive market. And I think we have seen that that doesn't happen. That's not happening. Barriers to entry are naturally higher than we previously expected. And if we allow monopolies to form, they will be persistent and they will not get competed away. And so I think that presumption needs to change.
Yeah. Thanks, Charlotte. John, I'll let you weigh in if you'd like, and then we have a little bit of time for some audience questions.
Okay, let's just go to the audience questions.
Okay. I'm assuming there's some. Maybe not. Are there audience questions?
If not, I can go on and on longer. People can flee.
I know that. Anybody? No? No question. Yes.
Hi, Sean from Senator Johnson's office. I'm just curious about maybe your take on the differences or maybe a divergence where we've seen the European Commission, specifically Ms. Vestergaard, kind of take on tech in a different way than maybe our regulators have. So can you just touch on maybe GDPR, if that's working or not, maybe like something similar here, or something on the antitrust side, competition side? Are they doing it the right way or the wrong way? What can we learn or not learn from what they've taken on?
So, GDPR is privacy, and the antitrust, FTC Bureau of Competition, doesn't deal with normative privacy laws, so I don't really have much to say about GDPR. I will say that the concern that we had about GDPR is that we felt that it could create an incumbency advantage, that it could be harmful to competition, which GDPR is not a competition statute. It's a normative privacy statute. We actually were afraid that it could create two problems. One is it could reduce investment, which seems to have been the case. Investment in Europe has fallen in the sectors affected by GDPR. But number two, we also were concerned that it could create an incumbency advantage because the effect it would have would be it would make it much harder for smaller startup firms to get data. Whereas if you're an incumbent, you already had the data, you could keep it. I don't know if there's any empirical research on what has turned out as a result of that. That was just a concern. In terms of antitrust enforcement, I think there's a couple of things to keep in mind. Number one, I'm not sure it's obvious that bringing cases equates to being right, okay? We are never going to, I think, win the title as the U.S. is never going to win the title as the jurisdiction that brings the most cases for the very simple reason that our cases go to court. And so we bring cases and we have to ultimately bear the burden of proof to prove that somebody broke the law. This is not the case in most other antitrust enforcement jurisdictions. In most other jurisdictions, the agency decides, and then it might be subject to judicial review under various levels of deference, but there's much, much less of a judicial check. And so therefore, inherently, you can bring more enforcement actions because there's less control over what the agency does. Here we have neutral courts that ultimately decide things, and that inherently acts as a check. Either we bring cases and we lose them, or as Charlotte points out, maybe there are some cases we're not bringing, although the kinds of cases you're talking about, I can tell you, I have zero experience with it. There's not a single case that we haven't brought because of litigation risks that I can think of. But I can't speak for all time, just for the last 2.5 years or so. The other important difference between Europe and the U.S., though, is that the laws are actually different. And most importantly, in that Europe has a concept called abusive dominance, which we do not have in our law. And that concept is that if you are a monopolist or you have a dominant share in Europe, so let's just say you're a company and you've succeeded, you've just become a dominant company simply because you're just better at what you do. People like you better, you have lower prices, you have better quality. Under European law, your behavior is then limited. you have to treat your competitors with a certain degree of niceness. I forget the exact
phrase. I think it's from a real
gentlemanly
like,
or something.
Compete like a gentleman.
Right. So you have to be nice to your competitors. Right. You can't charge too much. You know, you can have excessive pricing. No one has ever actually been able to define excessive price, and I actually edited a few law review articles on this where the conclusion was it's excessive if it's too high, which is a kind of difficult standard to operationalize. But there's this concept in Europe that if you're big, that your behavior should be restricted. We don't have that concept. In the U.S., our concept is if you're a dominant or a monopolist firm, you can do whatever you want, provided that you're not hindering competition. You're free to compete with the gloves off. You're free to charge whatever price you want. The theory is if you charge really high prices, that's going to attract entry. Now, that may or may not be true, right? So there's empirical questions that you can get at here to try to figure this out. But I think the difference in law is really important to understand. And I will also say I'm not a proponent of abusive dominance. I think it has, number one, it has a serious chilling effect on competition. The notion that if you succeed, you then are going to be hobbled and forced to cooperate with your competitors, I think is highly problematic. But secondly, and even more importantly, a lot of abusive dominance law has turned out to be impossible to articulate in an objective way. So you really end up with just the regulator's preference deciding things. And I will tell you that everyone here should have total confidence in me as a regulator to make decisions on my own with no standards left entirely to my discretion. I feel totally up to that job. But I'm not sure you should feel that same way about anybody who comes after me. You know, when Charlotte takes over the Bureau of Competition, for example, you might want to be worried. I mean, obviously I'm joking, but standardless enforcement is a dangerous thing. You know, it's good to have standards that you can say are objective, they're neutral, they're nonpartisan. You know, there are standards that everybody can point to and can understand if you violated it or not. And when you go away from that to discretionary standards, I think you get deeper and deeper and deeper into trouble where enforcement becomes politicized ultimately.
Yeah, thanks. Charlotte, I just want to make a quick plug. Bruce is talking about the investment. There's a paper by Liad Wagman and Ginger Jen on the impact of VC investment from GDPR. It's he presented some of that work at a conference that I put on Tuesday. So a little plug, you can find it on the website. You can find a link to the paper. So shameless plug for my stuff. But Charlotte?
So you've got the competition folks here and asking this question about a privacy law. So we might not be the biggest experts on GDPR. But in general, I think if GDPR is doing the privacy things that we want, the fact that it might make it harder for small businesses is something that we should weigh. But if the privacy priority is really important, that's fine, and we can choose that. The example that I often think of is, you know, we have environmental protections, and there might be small businesses that could survive if they could dump chemicals in the river, but we say that we don't want them to dump chemicals in the river, and some small businesses might go out of business as a result of that, and we've decided that this is an important policy, that we're willing to accept this. But one small point in response to Bruce's point about the data, in many areas, I think old data is not very useful. So if you make a change going forward, everybody won't be on an equal playing field, but the value of the old data that the incumbents have will continually go down and down. And if they aren't able to get any new data, then their incumbency advantage over those new entrants who cannot get the data because of the limitations decreases and decreases as time goes by.
Yes, although if that's true, that suggests that scope and scale effects from data are pretty limited.
No, it doesn't. because they in the U.S., they are continuing to get this data, right? So the scope is a scope of data streams that they continue to get.
So, John, did you want to?
I know we're at the end here, so let me just quickly just give you an example of Bruce's point about the differences in law. The Google search investigation was found that Google violated the antitrust laws in Europe, but not here in the U.S., and what the case was very quickly is that Google puts in their own stuff in their own search page, and so example shopping results, they're from Google, their own Google ads, Google content, and this pushes stuff down from competitors such as Nextag and Foundum at that time. And so Europe, they found that this was an antitrust violation. Why? Because it pushed them lower down on the page. And so it's almost a tautology. If you are introducing your own private label, if you will, product, that's going to hurt a competitor, and those competitors saw less business because of that entry. And they're dominant consequently have a special responsibility and consequently violate the antitrust laws. If you look at the actual case, there's nothing on consumer welfare, even though they operate under a consumer welfare standard in name, but not in practice for dominant firms. And secondly, if you look at it, they excluded Amazon as being relevant for shopping queries, which is really difficult to understand that type of decision, but that's how they get the dominant result. And so the European result, as Bruce said, when you look at it, it's almost void of any economics, any void of evidence, but more on principle. And so that's fine. If that's what the Europeans want, that's the approach that they get, but they're very different. And so just because Europe has a result doesn't mean that the U.S. is missing anything. And I think that's something that we have to avoid.
Yeah, Bruce, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to say one thing about self-referencing, actually, because this has been a big topic lately, where you're a platform and then you sell your own stuff.
Yeah, there's actually some proposed legislation, or at least one of the presidential candidates, I think, has a bill. Maybe
right.
It's Senator Warren who has a proposal
right.
that would ban platforms from self-dealing.
Right. So the only thing I would say about that is we know two good theories under antitrust law where self-referencing could be a problem. Right. The first situation is the Microsoft case. And this is where Microsoft preferenced its own internet browser because it identified Netscape and other browsers as a threat to its monopoly in the operating system, right? So it put its own product out there to quash this threat to its monopoly, and then that's clearly a potential problem. The second scenario is where the platform or the monopolist is gonna put its own product out there because it wants to monopolize that second downstream product. So for example, in the Microsoft case, if Microsoft wanted to monopolize browsers, or if I'm talking about shoes, say I'm Amazon, I sell shoes, I put my own shoes up on my website, it's because I want to monopolize shoes. So there's two theories. But it's important to remember that self-preferencing itself, in and of itself, is not inherently good or bad. There's a lot of sense, there's this kind of visceral sense that it's unfair, that there's something wrong about where if I'm a platform and I'm selling other people's stuff, if I have my own house brand, like if I'm a supermarket and I put a store brand on the shelves, that's somehow unfair. But fairness is not in and of itself a value under the antitrust laws. What we look at is the practice harmful or not? And there's a lot of reasons why self-preferencing might be beneficial. Notably, if what you're really concerned about is just increasing profits, you wouldn't do it by selling your own product because that's very costly. You would just raise the rent, right? I would just, if I'm an Amazon or somebody like that, I would just charge a little more from whoever is transacting over my platform rather than selling my own stuff. In fact, if I'm a platform, what I really want is just to drive more people to the platform and have them be happier using my platform. So a very likely reason why you might do some self-preferencing, why you might offer your own products and even prefer them, is not because of anything anti-competitive. It's because there's something wrong with what's being offered as it is. The products that are being offered are low quality or high price, or the consumer experience is bad. And because I don't really care if I'm a platform what you're buying on my platform. I just care that you're on there and you're buying stuff. I don't have a strong incentive to put some particular product on there. I just want to maximize the experience for everybody using it. So one good reason why I might engage in this behavior is actually to make things better for users. Now, I'm not saying that's the only reason. There are clearly, as I said at the beginning, are viable anti-competitive theories in self-preferencing. But it is not the case that self-preferencing is always bad. In fact, it's often good. So when you're doing antitrust enforcement, what you try to do is figure out what's going on here. Is this a good case, like the Microsoft case, or is it a bad case? And that's what law enforcement's about. That's why we do this as enforcement and not by just codifying them and saying this is always bad or always good, because the facts are actually much messier than that.
Right. Oh, no, go ahead. We're quite over, but no, go ahead, Charlotte.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think that self-preferencing can be a problem if the company that's doing the self-preferencing is a monopolist or dominant or has market power by the definition that we want to set. Maybe it's the antitrust definition, or maybe we think we need a different definition of dominance in some situations. So you could raise the rent to make more money, but at the same time, you want to have lots of sellers. And so it might not be rational to raise the rent because then that would decrease your number of sellers. But if you could do this confusing thing where you make it look like competition is really happening, but actually you're preferencing your own products or preferencing products that have a financial relationship with you, like using Fulfilled by Amazon or something like that, I think that can create unfairness in what might be a monopolist marketplace where people don't have the opportunity to leave and go to competitors. If that's the situation, then that should be a concern.
That's right. My point is simply that it's not unambiguously the case that it's bad or good. Right? It's a very fact-specific thing. And so when we talk about self-preferencing, it's really important to remember not to be confused by the fact that it seems unfair. Right? You have to actually look at what's going on here to figure out, is this a good or bad thing? And the answer to that is not always clear.
All right, that's we've solved these problems. It's not always clear. All right,
it's,
so that's our punchline. But thank you. thank you, audience, for indulging us for another 15 minutes. And thank you, panelists, for what a great discussion. So.
Thanks.